So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review.
Paul, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for doing the interview. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's been a while since we've had you on the program.
Well, make the most of it.
Without a doubt, this person is one of the most ingenious and manipulative minds in the history of this business.
Creative teacher.
Confident mentor.
Brilliant.
I never just wanted to be one of a crowd.
The greatest professional wrestling manager in the world today.
Mad scientist. Evil mastermind.
Mastermind.
I came in and said, boom, everything changes from this moment on.
ECW!
Yeah, he lied to you. Yeah, he wrote you some bad checks, but you still came back.
Untrustworthy. Aggressive.
It's too damn pushy.
Manipulative.
I'd fight a lot of battles that made no sense for me to fight.
If you can't trust someone, you can't be in business with them.
You would never have expected me back in this company.
Well, I should have known you were a liar when I met you. I should have known you had a secret little double life. I should have known you were the devil flying undercover. I should have known you'd fit the part. I should have known you were a star.
Hello and welcome to another week of Review Away. It's John Pollock, and it is Wei Ting wearing a hat.
Wearing a hat.
What does your hat stand for, Wei? It says F with some brackets around it.
This is just not good radio is what it is.
No, this is called integration of multiple platforms, because I'm going to take a picture of this.
Yeah.
No, I'm not, because this is already on our Instagram, this very hat you're wearing. So people can go to Instagram.com/lawradio to see this hat, to get the visual, and now you're going to give the story behind the hat.
Well, I don't think anybody cares that much.
They have already deleted this. They have already gone delete.
Yeah.
If they subscribe, they have unsubscribed if they are subscribing.
I wouldn't listen to this, but I'm wearing a hat of our brother's station, Fantasy Sports Network.
Why do people go back and forth between brother's station and sister station?
What have people said about us? What have people said in the past about Fantasy? I mean, I only say that because it's, I assume, pretty much our target demographic is males. That's all. So I suppose it's inappropriate of me to assume, but I only assume...
A lot of males work here.
Right. I'd only assume that the gender of our channel is male.
How about our cousin station?
I think we're closer than that.
Our stepbrother station. Our step-sibling.
Step-sibling?
Let's make it gender neutral.
What? That's probably more appropriate, because the Fight Network was born out of somebody else, and then it was acquired by our current boss.
Who had a new child.
Yeah, who had it. So, yes.
They are.
Our stepbrother station.
Yeah.
But stepbrother sounds like a little, you know, it makes it sound like we don't like each other that much.
Well, that's perpetuated on people by...
like Disney.
Yes.
Step-siblings. Evil stepsisters.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it goes back to Cinderella.
I think all evil is created by Disney in some form.
I did a course on film and television, and a large part of it was dissecting Disney films and other films of just the subtle themes that were pushed forward. And I once heard a radio show that broke down The Wizard of Oz, and it was horrifying. It's like this movie you loved as a child, and then it's like the overt or maybe subtle, like, racial tones of just all over it. And was this on purpose? Was this just – why was this perpetuated?
Yeah, I think, you know, as hard as we look at wrestling through a microscope, we could look at any – so many other mediums and probably find a lot of the same, you know, criticisms that we find in pro wrestling.
I watched The Expendables 3 this past weekend.
How was that?
It was about what you would apparently just tanked at the box office.
Really?
Just got destroyed. It was the worst opening for any of the Expendables movies. So
what did it, was it number one at least?
No, I think Ninja Turtles was this past weekend.
Wow.
Which wasn't even its first weekend out. I think it did something like 15 million, the Expendables did. And this featured Randy Couture, who's been on in all three of them, and Ronda Rousey, the boxer Victor Ortiz was in it. So a lot of people connected to kind of our world.
Well, how was the movie itself?
It was maybe the weakest of the three. Okay. I mean, it's just, it's dumb action, which I'm a big fan of. I went out with a bunch of my friends. We went drinking beforehand, and then we went and watched The Expendables. So it was a fun night. I had a good time just hanging out with my friends. And it was funny because Bruce Willis had some dispute and was not back for the third movie. So they took their shots at him during the movie, and that was great. Harrison Ford was now the new kind of authority for The Expendables. So Stallone goes up to him and said, I was expecting to be dealing with Church, who was Bruce Willis's character. And Harrison Ford just responds, forget about Church. Consider him out of the picture. And then later they took another shot at him, referring to him as an asshole. I love that stuff. I love when you can kind of cater to your audience that is aware of real life situations. Wrestling is gold for that kind of a thing. So that was fun. There, tons of great Arnold. If you're a fan of Arnold sound bites, there were plenty of them in this particular film. Him and Harrison Ford were great.
Okay, cool. Well, why don't you think it did as well this time in the box office?
That's a good question. I guess there just wasn't as much interest.
Are people just tired of, you know, star power being the draw? And like, do you think people
maybe star power just wasn't the draw? Like, look at Guardians of the Galaxy. When you really break that down, I mean, Bradley Cooper, Vin Diesel,
and they're not even, their faces aren't even on the thing. Vin Diesel has one line.
You could watch that movie and you would not even know that's Vin Diesel, nor that it's Bradley Cooper's voice.
But I will say, I mean, Bradley Cooper does a great job, and I will say Vin Diesel does a great job too as Crude. Because if you see, I've seen like some behind the scenes videos of this guy on YouTube. I mean, he went above and beyond of what was expected of him for this role. He actually like
became a tree.
Well, almost. He like on the set of the last Fast and the Furious movie, to get in the character, he wore one of those like stilt deals on his feet. One of those like kind of like the new, not wooden stilts, but like the plastic stilts at the end of your feet. He did that thinking to get into the mindset of a tree, he said. And
there's a certain level where you can appreciate, you know, character acting and mood acting, but there's another where it's like, this sounds stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't know how much it helped him at all, because how the hell do you even know what a tree sounds like? But to just even see this guy in the voiceover booth, it wasn't just going in there and, you know, saying, I'm Groot. Like, he had to, like, kind of dig deep and like kind of get into this headspace, and he does it for all the different languages too. So it's not like he signed this on as some type of joke. Like, he signed on taking this seriously,
much like he did for Triple X, another big
did he take
landmark.
That seriously?
I don't know. I just remember that movie for the line, "I live for this shit."
Yeah,
he lived for that shit.
Uh-huh.
He was in some horrendous movies, but he's also been in a lot of some of my favorite movies.
Oh, the Fast movies are excellent.
I love, outside of the second one, I've seen them all. The second one, so many people told me it just sucks. Don't even bother. Too Fast, Too Furious. Exhibit.
Was he in that one? I thought it was Ludacris.
No, Ludacris has been in a bunch of them.
Ludacris started in the second one.
He might have started in the second one, but he's been in like all of them up to
Exhibits,
this point.
Are you sure Exhibits?
I'm going to look this up right now. I'm almost positive Exhibit was in the second one.
Okay.
Do you want to bet something?
Yeah.
Lunch.
How about a pimped ride?
Okay. How about passes to the Canadian National Exhibition, which is now open in Toronto?
No. John has pulled up the Wikipedia.
How do you spell Exhibit?
X.
Z. Oh, boy. I might owe lunch to somebody. Yeah. I could have sworn he was in one of these fucking films.
You're thinking of the other Corn Road rapper.
No, I could have sworn he was in one of them.
No, I don't think he is.
Well, okay. Nonetheless, fantastic movies. Exhibit, Fast and the Furious.
You're just thinking about cars. That's why. because you identify Exhibit with stupid cars. But you know the great thing about the fast.
He did the song "Ride or Die." Yeah, dude, I think I'm right here. I think I'm right.
Is he in it? You really care about this.
Yeah, I don't like to lose. In the era of the fact-checking thread, this is a big deal to me. Okay, I'm giving up. The word furious is not in his Wikipedia page. So who am I thinking of?
You're thinking of Ludacris. Like, I've told you like
You know what?
Times
he was
now.
In XXX, State of the Union.
All right.
God, he's been in quite a few films here. The X-Files, I Want to Believe.
I know people are certainly not listening anymore. And it doesn't really bode well for our fifth anniversary.
Yeah, when's that coming up?
The week of September 11th.
September 10th. That's in 2 weeks. 3 weeks.
Yep.
I have an idea. Someone gave me a good suggestion. Have you received any suggestions for the review?
I have, yeah. I have.
Okay, we'll debate.
Nothing really standing out, but okay.
All right, we'll figure something out. That's in weeks from now. While we talk about character acting, this is a good segue. Do you remember that Paul Heyman promo last year when he cried during the CM Punk?
Oh, they played it during the the one where he's with Renee backstage. Like, you mean the one they played in the documentary at length?
Yeah. I think that one.
He's sort of fake crying.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was in his interview with Ariel Helwani. He was explaining that to get into that.
No. I think we're talking about a different one.
It was last year. It was during the Punk feud, and he cried.
It's not like, the one where he's like mockingly crying. Like
this was like serious crying.
Yeah.
And he said to get into that headspace, into that character, he had a tie from his father's funeral,
That his father used to own.
And he wore the tie, and he left it in his bag right until he had to do the promo.
Yeah.
And I guess he used the smell of the tie, and it brought him back to his dad's funeral to elicit that response.
Oh, yeah.
When I hear that in pro wrestling, it's like this guy is operating on a level that I would say maybe nobody in the industry is right now. It's incredible.
It also makes me wonder what type of potential this guy would have had, had he not decided to go into wrestling, had he decided to maybe become an actor.
Yeah, take that leap from Rollerball and see where it would take him.
Oh, that's right.
Did you ever see Rollerball?
No, I did not.
I saw that in the theater.
How was he in that?
He was very minimal. And a lot of people in ECW were pissed because that was filmed in 2000 when, Paul was saying he was off trying to negotiate a new TV deal, and he was going to LA and filming Rollerball during this time when, it'd be the equivalent of literally right now, Dixie Carter off auditioning for movie roles while the company is in peril.
Right.
So anyway, Rollerball, not a great movie.
But just the amount of depth I think this guy, took pride in his on-air performances. Very, very interesting. Very fascinating.
Well, we'll dive into the documentary because this has been probably the most anticipated release from the WWE this year. The company, for the last couple of years, you've really seen this shift when it comes to their DVD projects of making them these really big projects where you can see that a lot of money is put into them. A lot of outside voices are brought in. In this particular one, we had a ton of people. Gabe Sapolsky on a WWE DVD. Mm-hmm. Couldn't plug Evolve, unfortunately.
No.
We're doing Paul Heyman DVD taping day one of two, back tomorrow afternoon, live in Stanford. I love those promos.
Oh, man.
I fucking love them.
Those Ring of Honor tapes with his commentary. I
want an endless loop of those intros for the ROH show. Someone should put that on YouTube. Just like an endless
The best
loop.
Of Gabe what's his name? Jimmy.
Jimmy Bauer?
Yeah, Jimmy Bauer.
Yes. No this relation to Court.
Yeah.
So, Gabe Sapolsky's in this. Raven. Todd Gordon.
Bill Apter,
CM Punk, Jim Ross. I mean, just way too long a list. The funniest, though, is that if you watch the trailer that they put out, it's just a variety of sound-ups. And Renee Young says something to the effect of, he's great at what he does. And that's in the trailer. And that is literally how much of her is in the documentary portion. It is that exact line.
There was a bit more, I'd say.
I don't think there was, because I was paying attention to it.
Well, I mean, I just remember the part where Renee, or at least he talks a lot about
Renee. Yeah, he talks a lot about her. And maybe there was more stuff in the added stories.
There's a little bit more, but it probably wasn't much more than that.
He is extremely high on Renee mm-hmm. Young. Any chance he gets, he just talks about what an extremely talented person she is.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she is really kind of redefining that role. Someone that has been put into this place during, let's be honest, an extremely scripted era for that kind of a talent, and adds her own personality to it and has really, you know, look where she has evolved to within that company.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Maybe we'll be reviewing the Renee Young DVD next year.
Someday.
Yeah.
We'll get maybe a former producer to guest on our show.
Renee, Young and Restless, the story of the WWE announcer. How the WWE scored
Young
the voice
restless.
Of a generation.
Yes. I'm sure we'll be seeing some maybe Jason Agnew would be interviewed.
He would have to be.
He'd be the
I would want. I would want that. I would want all of Matt Chin and their segments together to air.
He would be the Gabe
Rick Thompson.
Yeah, he'd be the Gabe of that documentary.
That would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Could get Arda on there.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Corderas. Be great. Yeah. Tons of CanCon.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's get back to Paul Heyman here. Did you like the DVD?
I liked it a lot. Definitely. I mean, I thought it was sort of the definitive look at the man behind this character that we see and praise so often. I think what's unique about him, though, is that not only was he I think everybody knows him for being, his legacy being ECW, but I think we all fail to realize how long of a career he's had in front of the camera simply as a manager. If you just look at it, I mean, this has been one of the longest-lasting managers in professional wrestling, starting from the 80s up until today.
Yeah, I really like the way that, you know, watching all of this in one documentary, you got to see all these different chapters of his career, from the cameraman who was scheming his way backstage at shows into Paulie Dangerously in Memphis, to the Paulie Dangerously behind the Dangerous Alliance, to the ECW promoter Paul Heyman, to the WWE version of Paul Heyman, even into this current iteration, which was very different from when he came in 2001 as an announcer. He has made so many changes. I mean, just the guy with the ball cap and trench coat with the press passes, that's such a far departure from the advocate version of Paul Heyman we see today. There's been so many changes. The advocate Jew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, throughout this show, over the years, we have had Paul Heyman on the show a number of times. So we're going to be drawing from some of those clips. We first had him on the show back in 1999, right before, I believe it was the November to Remember show in Buffalo, which was a famous show for longtime Law listeners, because that was the show where Dan Lavransky and Jason Agnew were on their way to the show and got to the border.
Oh, no.
And Dan Lavransky was turned away because he had no identification past a bank card. And they did not make their way to the Burt Flickinger Center that night for the November to Remember show. But Paul Heyman was on the Law. I think it was the weekend of, when it was a Saturday afternoon slot. Unfortunately, that interview is not accessible. But what we do have is a very lengthy interview that Heyman did back in. It's cool because we have interviews with him from very distinct parts of his career. We have him literally 2-3 days before he was sent home by the WWE after December to Remember. He came on with Jason Agnew to promote that pay-per-view, and that's about a 45-minute chat. Then a few years later, I got a hold of him, and we did a lengthy chat during his hiatus from wrestling. And then we did also just recently a brief interview with him promoting this DVD. So some different eras of Paul Heyman that you will hear clips from when me and Wei want a break and want to listen to Paul Heyman tell his own story. So there you go. We're going to take the documentary, and we're going to up it here on Review Away.
I love it.
That's the goal. Now, I guess we can start near the beginning with Heyman, who I don't know how familiar you were with just the story of just his upbringing here. I mean, quite the story involving his mom, who is a Holocaust survivor who had just passed away a few years ago, and his father, who was a personal injury lawyer, that Heyman would say he would watch his dad perform in court as an advocate for his clients. And he said he's drawn a ton of that from his father for this current run right now, where he basically turns the audience into a jury and he is advocating for his client. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just remarkable to get inside this guy's head of what the thought process is. We see the finished product, and an interview or a documentary like this, you kind of get to see the breadcrumbs of where this idea begins and what you see on television.
I thought it sort of played out as sort of like a superhero origin story, the way he described it, where you can clearly see you know what this guy is like, and you can clearly see how the pieces of his past and his parents' upbringing come together to form the guy that you see today.
I love the early story of when he's starting to break into the business, trying to find his way in, and he did it the same way Jim Cornette did, just taking photos at ringside and eventually scheming his way to get a pass from the Worldwide Wrestling Federation at Madison Square Garden. And we're getting all this early praise of Paul Heyman, and he'd become this genius, and we get, of all people, Bill Apter. He says, "I hated this fucking kid because I would be going for a nice shot and there would always be an elbow to my side and he would ruin the shot for me." And I instantly thought of you, Wei, who must appreciate this kind of thing when you're trying to shoot something and some dick knocks into you. When you're in one of those marathon scrums, people putting their mics in the way of you. I mean, it's dog-eat-dog world for you people out there, and I'm sure you sympathize with one Bill Apter.
I totally sympathize with him.
Yeah, so that was an interesting story of his way kind of into things. Also working as a publicist at Studio 54, he would promote his first event there, built around giving this Man of the Year award to Ric Flair. Just like these wacky ideas.
Some bullshit award.
Really, yeah.
Just to promote a night out. And I think what stood out to me was the fact that he had never promoted any type of event before this, but basically told the promoters, lied about his prior experience to get the job. And, I mean, look where he is today.
That's what you just have to do. Someone says, "Hey, do you have experience doing this?" You just lie. You say, "Of course."
Yeah.
It's like when you started here, Wei, they said, "Hey, can you cut a feature?" "Of course I can cut a feature."
No, I didn't say that.
And look how you have ascended. You really are.
If anything, I should lie more, I think.
I think people view you here at the Fight Network as like the Paul Heyman of,
I doubt it.
Of camera work and editing.
I got a hat on right now.
Exactly. You're wearing your Fight Network press pass right now.
My trench coat.
It's really hot. I don't know why you're wearing that. Indoors, no less.
It's a good look.
It's very hot.
My ponytail is tied up.
You should grow a ponytail.
Yeah, I should.
Could be your gimmick.
I'll wait till I go completely bald and I'll grow a little skullet.
Skullet. Yeah. I'm trying to envision you right now with a skullet.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
That'd be nice.
And they pretty much just go through kind of the origins, the character of Polly Dangerously, the name coming from the movie Johnny Dangerously and Michael Keaton.
Because I guess he did bear quite a resemblance to Michael Keaton.
Yeah, they really showed the photo of him, and when you go back to that era of Paul Heyman, very, very similar. He literally was, talk about an origin story, he was Batman before Michael Keaton was Batman.
I don't know about that. He was Batman. He was the guy who would have ultimately become Batman.
Yes.
Yes.
Could have been Batman.
Could have played Batman, yes.
Or
a fat Batman.
Fat man.
No.
We go through his time just in various territories, really getting a big break working in Memphis, where he kind of clashed with Jerry Lawler while they were both down there, and Heyman was attached with Austin Idol, Tommy Rich. After that breakup, we would see him go to other territories, including the AWA, which was kind of on its last legs at this point, but still had good exposure on ESPN. And he explains in the documentary how, they had all of this time to fill, and promos were a great way to fill that time. And it got Paul Heyman essentially just getting his reps in, where he got to go out there and cut promos all day long at these TVs, and he would jump at those opportunities just to get mic time on the show. So it might have not been the biggest promotion at the time, but he was a big focus of these shows just by necessity.
Well, we got on ESPN a lot, not to mention the reps, that probably he probably used to kind of really just hone his abilities. And just kind of going back to the Memphis thing, they had Lawler basically speak at length here about Paul Heyman. And
not a Paul Heyman guy, he noted.
But I just I love the fact that, you know, the WWE at this point, if they decide to go back to do a documentary on one of these people, they have access to basically so many facets of one person's career that you can even – I mean, not only do they have footage from Memphis, they were able to find the guy in charge of the
place. I thought we had the rights to Memphis.
Well, I thought we did too.
It's a big dispute over who has the rights to Memphis. It's there are many stepfathers to the Memphis Library.
Yes.
But this is great. And I think that's why, especially for a subject like Paul Heyman, the expectations are so high, because it's not like you're doing this on a small budget and trying to, you know, meander footage, where it's like the WWE has the keys to the castle here. Mm-hmm. They can do everything. You can tell a guy's entire career. You have all the talking heads you want, and you have virtually all of the footage you need to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that with CM Punk. We saw, you know, the AWA footage that they had the rights to here, obviously, that they own. From there, going over to Continental, which is where he would first hook up with Eddie Gilbert, who would be a big part in that Eastern Championship Wrestling run, which would evolve into Extreme Championship Wrestling, a stint in Windy City Wrestling, and then going to the NWA, where they did the original Midnight Express of Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, which Paul Heyman was managing, against Jim Cornette's updated version with Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane. And they showed the angle, which got over tremendously well, which you had Cornette with the white jacket and just bleeding like a stuck pig on television. But the angle didn't really go, the storyline didn't go that long with the two Midnight Express versions. But this was Heyman's entry into WCW at the time, where he would eventually score a very, very lucrative contract and then kind of butt heads when that big contract was held against Heyman.
Yes, that's right. But along the way, he went on to form the Dangerous Alliance, you know, basically citing it as sort of his version of the Horsemen, with, you know, Steve Austin, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton, Medusa. But basically, you know, the whole goal, he seemed to say, was to improve Steve Austin's abilities, a very young Steve Austin at the time, his abilities, by having him hang out with Paul Heyman and hanging out with Rick Rude. And, I mean, I think a lot of people probably, you know that he was in the WCW, but I think for especially a younger generation who didn't even know he had this association, or even the fact that Steve Austin had this career prior to him being Stone Cold, this is a really cool look back at this linking between two individuals that we both know today in different reincarnations at a different time.
Yeah, and they really didn't touch upon it too much, but also he was paired with Mark Calloway at this time in WCW, and you link him to very early.
Man, I wonder if they purposefully don't want to show that stuff of The Undertaker.
Well, that's interesting, because, I mean, Heyman recently noted in an interview the fact that there's this great story to tell, and he really pitched it for WrestleMania to kind of tell that story, that he gave The Undertaker his first big break, and also hinted at the fact that he had something to do with Calloway getting into the WWF, a story that he thought could have been excellent and maybe holding on to it, but for whatever reason, they didn't decide to go that direction this year for WrestleMania. But there is that backstory that's never been explored.
But it's a different case with The Undertaker, in that I think the WWE would rather have you believe that this guy
didn't have a career prior to The Undertaker. He's some wrestler that came up the indies, and
they want you to think that he actually came from the graveyard.
He is the dead man.
Exactly.
Also, this was the time period where he did have a suspension after he was also introduced to Jim Ross, and they became a very formidable commentary team. And that's always been a difficult transition for a lot of guys who might be great promo guys, but that doesn't always transfer to being a great commentator. Mm-hmm. And with Heyman, completely relied on Jim Ross, he said, who taught him so much at this time. And then this was kind of the first version of those two, which we would get a decade later in 2001 when he came back.
He said, I mean, he was very complimentary of Jim Ross. He said he learned more from Jim Ross than any of his other people that he's worked with in the past. And he also said that working as a commentator with JR made him a better manager. So I found that very interesting. I also love the way,
they kind of jumped around the issue of his firing from WCW, where they basically, you know, talk about his whole thing with the Dangerous Alliance, and all of a sudden they cut to sort of a silent Raw shot of Heyman being asked off a camera by a producer, "So why did you leave WCW?" And then he just basically talks about how he was fired and that he had a lawsuit with WCW and that he won a lot of money, but if he were to talk about it even now, they would all get sued. And that was it. That was all the explanation that really, I mean, you needed. I mean, no questions asked, you know, that he was fired. He can't talk about it because he sued them. And that was it. I thought it was sort of like a cheeky but, you know, clever way of answering that question.
Yeah, well, the bare bones of the story that is known is that, you know, when Kip Fry
Wait a second. Are you sure you want to say this? Otherwise, we might get sued here.
Maybe. Well, allegedly. We'll just throw in that word. Okay. Paul Heyman scored a huge contract with WCW. It was in the neighborhood of like $256,000 a year. And at a time when Bill Watts was brought in to kind of bring costs down, you look at your balance sheet here and you're seeing, Jesus Christ, this manager is making what? And Heyman wasn't going to take a pay cut. And then it also got into kind of alleging that Heyman was scamming them, because part of his contract was that WCW had to also pay for his hotel costs on the road. And there was a story that he was staying with a girlfriend in Atlanta, but still invoicing a hotel. And, you know, whether that was true or not, that was the story that was out. And it ended with a lawsuit, and Heyman got a bit of a settlement out of that, and that was the end of his run. So whatever, you know, those contents were sealed or so, those are kind of the story that is out there. And that's not, you know, like...
Allegedly.
So that was his exit from WCW at the time. And then kind of talked about this brief in-between period where they wanted him to start a morning talk show in the New York market going head-to-head with Howard Stern. But it never came to fruition after Jim Crockett was – this was after he had sold to Ted Turner, obviously, and was looking to get back into the wrestling business and wanted Heyman to come in and work with him. And that promotion lasted all of one television taping, really went nowhere. And this time period is kind of just quickly moved over to the Eastern Championship Wrestling portion, which would become the biggest portion of his career up until that time, where he came in as – an assistant booker to Eddie Gilbert in Eastern Championship Wrestling.
It's hard to believe that even up until this point in the story where he had accomplished so much in his career, the guy was only 27 years old by the time he
Yeah, you've always – Paul Heyman, to some people, to a lesser extent, has like that Earl Hebner syndrome where you just always assume the guy's been 40.
Yeah.
And he's really not that old.
Uh-huh. No, he's like about the same age as Brock Lesnar, isn't he? Or maybe...
No, he's older than that. He's past his 40s at this point. Well, okay. Mid-40s.
Okay.
So he comes into Eastern Championship Wrestling. He actually replaced Eddie Gilbert, who had some falling out with Todd Gordon, who was also a big part of this documentary and some of the extras on the DVD, particularly one of my favorite stories, which we'll get into later. But Heyman was brought in, and that's where all the changes were implemented. And, of course, they didn't really dive too much into the whole controversy involving that NWA title tournament in mid-94 where, famously, Shane Douglas dropped the title.
I think they purposefully left out a lot of what you could already get from like that ECW.
Yeah, this wasn't I think most people, you know, you have a separate DVD that explores that very much so. And you kind of, when you're picking and choosing what stories you're going to dive into, it wasn't as important as what was happening here, changing it into Extreme Championship Wrestling. And this is where we got to really hear from a lot of the stalwarts at the time. Tommy Dreamer, Raven, Gabe Sapolsky, Rob Van Dam. Like, as you mentioned, they pretty much had the key people you would want to hear from in this kind of a document. Joey Styles as well.
Yeah, I suppose the people you were missing were people that were only the people that were assigned to TNA, basically, you know. Taz obviously would have probably helped at certain parts. He was mentioned a lot but never shown in interview form. I imagine somebody like a Bully Ray would have been great too.
Yeah, which a year from now, though, all could be potential interviews for the follow-up DVD. Mm-hmm. They chose interesting stories here because, you know, for the longest time, it was always that, you know, Paul Heyman was secretly being paid and included on the WWF payroll. And he addressed this. His side was that the WWF wanted to bring in Too Cold Scorpio, but at the time, they had worked out a deal with Tommy Boy Records, where Tommy Boy Records would pay them $1,000 every week, and it would be, you know, Scorpio would come out to his music, and they would plug the Tommy Boy Records at the time. So when Scorpio left, they were losing that $1,000 a week sponsorship. The WWF would pay them in return, and it wouldn't go straight to Heyman. It would go to their parent company, the HHG Corporation, which was essentially getting the money that would fund the company. But for the forever, I mean, it was Paul Heyman positioning ECW as, hey, we are the island of misfit toys fighting against the big powers that be and rallying that talent against the big bad superpowers of WCW and the WWF, when quietly you were being funded by the WWF. Yeah. And in varying degrees over the years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think it just kind of showed you. In the end, do you think people really cared? I mean, I think everybody was entertained. You know, there's a great story and a great product there as a result. You know, but in the end, I think we all realize, oh, okay, this is really just part of the scheme, part of the plan. But I just thought that was such a funny, long explanation about a story involving Tommy Boy Records, Too Cold Scorpio, Vince McMahon, and ECW. Like, just two of the items probably go together, but like three of them I don't see any relation. Yet this was a lengthy part of the documentary, beautifully explained by Paul Heyman, about why he was not getting paid by ECW or WWE.
This interview, this sit down they did with Heyman, I mean, it was done. It was something like a 16-hour interview, Heyman said they did.
Wow.
I mean, can you imagine that? 16-hour sit-down. I would be dead. Like, yeah. Could you imagine us doing a podcast right now for 16 hours? That's essentially what it was.
No, I'd be asleep.
And I wonder how much content they're going to have for years and years that you've never even seen that can be used for various other projects.
I suppose. I mean, I'd hate to be the editor or the producer to have to go through all that, but I suppose.
I feel every month for the next like year and a half, you could just put up
like
an hour of that.
Yeah.
Just unedited. Just an hour just of the Paul Heyman interview.
They should just put that on the network. Raw interview.
Yeah. 1 hour every month for 16 months.
They'll never do that.
They should. I think people would totally watch. People who watch the DVD would still watch that.
Absolutely.
I think there's insane fans out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'd watch it. Since we're talking about a shoot interview here, that's what those tapes are. They're just kind of long form, unedited interviews.
Yeah, he almost got Ariel Helwani to do the interview for the documentary.
Oh, is that right?
He was going to have him. He pitched it to have Ariel Helwani do the interview.
Oh, but they never asked.
It just never got. It was a suggestion by Heyman, and they decided not to do it.
Oh, interesting.
So it would have been a lengthy edition of the Wrestling Hour. So from there, they had some really cool stuff here, and this was just pure luck, maybe. Or maybe it was by design of just always having the cameras rolling before an interview.
I imagine a lot of this was probably just the raw footage they ended up acquiring when they acquired the ECW library.
I'm stunned this stuff was saved over the years, you know what I mean? Like, on a company on such a tight budget, like, to just get rid of shit would have been so easy. And I just loved watching this. Watching Sally Graziano struggle as Heyman is producing him like a maniac. I would have lost my mind on Heyman if I was this talent.
This, to me, was the highlight of this documentary. Just to see the behind-the-scenes footage of how this man operates. I mean, we all know. We all see his results. We all see the end product of what he's able to accomplish. But we don't really see him actually at work coaching these talents, you know. We always say, well, this guy's so great at building people up, at making people, improve based off of what they have. But what exactly does that mean, you know? But now you get to see it. You see him get to say, again, Sal, again. My favorite part was when
– It was uncomfortable.
It was so uncomfortable. But and I love the fact that in this documentary they chose to basically leave that clip – you know, of Heyman uncomfortably coaching Sal. They left it basically sort of like a minute here of him telling him, again, do it again with more passion. It was great.
There's going to be a generation of wrestling fans. This will be their only acknowledgement of Big Sally Graziano.
Sure.
This will be maybe his legacy in wrestling, the guy that Heyman coached the documentary.
But I thought another awesome clip of him coaching Rhino after Rhino had won the ECW championship.
Oh, and it's like
telling Rhino to Rhino, when you say my name is Rhino, hold up the belt so that people subliminally associate the title with the name Rhino. Just him explaining that to one of his talents, I thought was so cool to see.
Yeah, and he really instilled this in a lot of guys. I just listened to Tommy Dreamer on Steve Austin's show, and he was telling me telling Austin about they would watch, you know, tapes of like Hogan and just what Heyman would take away. Like Hogan would walk out and he would stop and he would look around at the crowd, and it would be like, you're doing that because you're giving the audience at home the illusion that everyone in this arena has their eyes on you.
Mm-hmm.
And just picking up these little nuances and put the title close, associate your face with the title. And it's one in the same. I mean, just
shit.
So much stuff.
I love that stuff. Yeah. I love it, man. Like
I could have watched an hour of these just random clips of him producing talent, and I would have been just fascinated.
I think often, you know, like, I mean, we work here at the Fight Network where, you know, like Robin and Randy and yourself, you guys do a great job breaking down the technicalities of fighting, you know, like how, what, you know, this little head movement right here, what does that mean? How does this telegraph this? How does that? But I think you can look at pro wrestling in very much the same way. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the technical maneuvers, but it's the little things like that, like Hogan looking around the arena to signify to the audience that, oh, there are people watching, or Rhino holding up the title while saying the word saying his name to draw that. There's so much psychology involved that never ever gets talked about. Maybe for good reason, you know, they're sort of secrets. But I mean, just as a fan, it's so fascinating because it's you don't often watch wrestling through that lens.
Yeah, and I always found, like, with a Heyman, Hulk Hogan was like this. You know, I was onto that at a certain point where it's like, you know, the guys that are, they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? Whether it be an interview, and you'd always start to just, like, what's the angle here? What are they trying to do with this? And that's always something very interesting, like, you can find. And to this day with Hulk Hogan, I mean, nothing happens by chance. You know what I mean? Very little does, other than a sex tape or a
super astronaut, whatever. Whatever you call the arena?
Oh yeah, the Silver Dome.
Silver Dome. Yes.
At the Super Dome. So from there was this great story where they interviewed Ron Buffone, who was the guy that they would essentially edit all of the shows with Heyman, and told this hilarious story about how Paul once fired his mother. She wasn't doing a good enough job.
Mm-hmm.
There was also different stories about how he would cheap out on talent flights using bereavement fare.
Yes.
Where they would give them a story. I didn't even realize this, that you can get a cheaper flight if someone is ill or has died and you're flying somewhere.
Yeah, I had heard that somewhere, maybe from that Helwani interview one of the interviews.
So just a lot of kind of – they did spend a lot of time, not a huge amount of time, but they tried to take a more balanced look at Paul Heyman. I mean, this wasn't just a glorification of the guy. There was a lot of negative. They had Stephanie McMahon there to kind of explain things where I thought Stephanie was almost pandering at certain times, where it was like she would almost describe Paul as like this comedic character in a corporate environment, and it was just almost like she was discussing like a little child that didn't know how to behave. It's like, Paul, you cannot say that. We will do whatever you want, but when you're doing this, it's just not right. And it was just such a, like,
I think that's how she is, though.
I bet she really is like that.
How she talks to everybody.
It was just like this description where it sounded like she was talking about a problem child. Mm-hmm. And describing Paul as a child,
right? But who's to say that she was wrong? Maybe that's how he actually
I'm not saying right or wrong. I was glad she was in this documentary.
Oh, totally.
There's obviously going to be. We were very critical of the Triple H documentary for the opposite, and I would have been the same if it was 2 hours of nonstop love for Paul Heyman, because I think that there's a certain fan base that will subscribe that nothing Paul Heyman touches turns to anything but gold, and it's not true. Like, it's just
he's not true of any man.
He has done a fantastic job of really giving people this perception of him. A lot of it warranted, but at the same time has pissed off a lot of people along the way and done stuff that people are furious at the man for. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you did at least have that balance here in the documentary. And I think it was fair. I didn't think there were any necessary cheap shots at him. Yeah. But I really felt Paul does take it personally when the bad businessman, good promoter label is thrown at him and explaining his side of things when ECW was crumbling in 2000. They were behind on pay from In Demand, trying to get a new television deal, and explaining that his lies, it was how he was going to survive this thing, was, you know, taking nasty shortcuts, and it didn't always leave him the most popular person. To a lot of these talents who were fucked on pay, that never saw a dime of some of this stuff.
Yeah. And at the same time, you had the talents explaining their side about why, despite not being paid, why they would still continue to work for this guy. And I think, you know, they kind of took that opportunity to explain how this man was just – he was able to make you think that he was working – that you were working for a greater cause. That you – you know, at one point, Rob Van Dam, I believe, he says that – you know, he was able to make you believe that as part of the audience, you were in control of the show. The audience was the one writing the show, not just, you know, viewing and watching somebody else's product, but actually contributing.
Yeah, and you really got the sense. I mean, you compare these two promotions going out of business right around the same time in WCW and ECW, and what a difference the reaction was. Like, you got the sense from hearing a number of these guys that the biggest fans of ECW were many of the guys that were working for ECW. I mean, I go back to the Tommy Dreamer interview. He flat out said he was suicidal after ECW went out of business. He had nothing else in his life but this company. And he was someone that totally bought into it, put in tons of his own money into this, was out tons and tons of money, and was on the brink of killing himself after ECW went out of business. And a lot of this talent, I think they saw things that, man, there's not going to be any options for me with ECW gone. Whereas you don't really get that sense with WCW. A lot of them had options in the WWF, weren't as concerned about it, and you don't get that kind of nostalgia for WCW that ECW still brings about to this day. And this project is evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of these guys, they found out that ECW was officially dead when Heyman showed up on WWF television, which was in March of 2001 after Jerry Lawler had quit the company. And it was that famous shot where it comes up on Jim Ross and they pan to the left and it's Paul Heyman. And everyone just, you know, stunned here that it was Heyman coming in.
Do you think Heyman would be involved today in wrestling still had Jerry Lawler not left?
Absolutely. I think that he, from what I understand, had a deal to come into the WWF even prior to Lawler leaving. I mean, there was going to be some role for him, whether it be in creative or some other avenue to use this guy. So I 100% believe that had Lawler still remained there, there would have been a spot for him. And maybe it would have been on SmackDown. Maybe it would have been as a manager. Maybe it would have been strictly behind the scenes. But I completely believe WWF would have brought him in. And that takes us into the WWF, WWE years, where he explained he didn't have a contract until 2 months in. He then explains his run overlooking SmackDown after the brand extension, which he described as the bitch of the WWE, mm-hmm. the B show, which was interesting to hear on a WWE DVD, so flat out label one show as the B show, which you always hear from anyone that's worked on SmackDown, or, I mean, just general perception. But to actually hear it, you know, this was the B show at the time, and that's what he inherited.
Yeah, I love the honesty on their own DVD.
And that was the time period when SmackDown was at such a high with the SmackDown 6, and Heyman explaining how they were able to create a lot of new stars without hurting the existing stars that they had at the time, like Lesnar, Hogan, Undertaker. And it was a really great period of SmackDown during that time. And then Heyman was removed in February of 2003. And they go over the conference call deal. Do you want to explain this story?
I don't even know where the story
was. Was this not in the documentary, or was this an extra?
Well, this wasn't in the documentary proper.
Okay, well, the extra is where they would have weekly conference calls first they would do the Raw team, and you'd have to call in, you'd have to sign in on the conference call system. Then the Raw call would end, and I guess they'd do SmackDown first and then Raw. So he was there for the SmackDown call, and then everyone leaves, and then the Raw call begins, and about halfway through the meeting, the moderator announces that this number has left the call. And they didn't know who it was. And it turned out to be Paul Heyman's cell phone that had been listening in on the Raw call, and he had been outed. And Heyman explained that he had left his cell phone on or something to that. It's this really elaborate story that you certainly have to raise your eyebrow to, of the fact that his cell phone was, it ran out of batteries. And therefore, when the phone died, it disconnected from the conference call. And Heyman explained, I was not listening in on that conference call. However, the past 5 weeks, I was listening in on the Raw call because that's what they deep down wanted, was cutthroat competition. And I was willing to do anything to beat Raw. And that's why he was replaced one of many times and taken off the creative team.
Interesting.
So that was one of the many stories. And we heard from guys that he really assisted during this time. Edge, Big Show, who was a huge act that was pushed by Paul Heyman and pretty much got the most out of Big Show. I think you can look back at his WWE tenure, was that time when he beat Lesnar. They booked him in short matches and trying to get the most out of him. And then we go through the time being sent down to Ohio Valley Wrestling, where he first met up with CM Punk.
This is the guy that's being positioned as the next one, I would think, out of ECW. I mean, your thoughts on where you see Punk going?
Straight to the top. I mean, Punk embodies a new look, a new vision, a new style for sports entertainment. He is a hybrid of the mixed martial arts world and the old school professional wrestling world, or even the new school professional wrestling world. I think Punk is a complete package. And, you know, he's articulate, he's intelligent, he knows how to carry his message, how to convey his thoughts. His in-ring action is spectacular. And I see nothing but huge things for CM Punk. When he was sent, when I was in OVW, in the developmental territory, and he came down there, I mean, immediately it was obvious this guy has it all. He demonstrated that in Ring of Honor and everywhere else that he's been, and he's a guy that's going to be on top for a long, long time.
They started working together very much, and then into the whole ECW reunion period in 2005 with One Night Stand. And then the idea presented to make this an online digital show.
By the way, the Punk interviews were clearly done prior to his departure.
Yeah, I don't think Punk was flying into Stanford to do any touch-ups on these interviews. Mm. So Punk very much featured in the documentary. And I'm glad he was. I'm glad they didn't make some stupid call like, we're going to remove him and we're going to hurt our own product for whatever reason. So he added quite a lot.
He, after One Night Stand, Heyman explains that there was a time when Shane almost bought ECW as a grooming, I guess, territory for him before taking over the WWE, but then that never actually panned out.
Yeah, in 2000, when ECW was certainly having those problems, there were a number of different promotions. At one time, ECW was being discussed as a promotion for Shane to run. And then later, a year or two later, they were also batting around the same idea of the WWE purchasing the UFC for Shane to run at the time when the UFC was bleeding money, just tons of it. And that also didn't obviously come to fruition. But that kind of idea of a satellite promotion that Shane McMahon would run, whether it be pro wrestling or mixed martial arts. And neither of them happening.
Now the guy's out completely.
Yeah. So this is where I also had my note. Stephanie literally called him, and his antics were those of a petulant child at the time. And Heyman kind of explained it that, you know, when he was running creative, he would be a destructive person to himself because he would not let any – he would fight for everything. Every one of his ideas, he was willing to die for these things. And fighting and not – knowing that there's certain battles to fight and there's others not to. And that is why I think you will never see this guy in a creative position again. I just think it's not, at least this version of the creative team is really not conducive to having a Paul Heyman as a component as opposed to the overall creative force behind
yeah,
the company.
He definitely seems like somebody who has a specific vision, and if he doesn't get his way, he just gets really upset.
Well, one of the key things that you did manage to do, and you talked about it for that first ECW pay-per-view, that was an absolutely incredible show, but a lot of it was the hardcores coming back and based on nostalgia. Do you think you've lost that at this point with the new ECW?
Oh, I think the original ECW fan base is if not gone, has certainly dwindled down considerably. And,
right.
and I understand why. This is not the product that they wanted. This is not the product that they were looking forward to seeing. This is not the reunion and the taking up where we left off that they were hoping and praying and clamoring for. This is a distinctly different product, geared towards a distinctly different audience, and it's not going to appeal to the original fan base. And I understand their concerns, and I understand why they're not turned on by the new product. It's a different product than what they were hoping for.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, you're the person that's directly responsible for conjuring up that original fan base, and now you've lost them with what is can be termed, you know, your new creation.
It's not my company anymore.
Okay.
I don't own it, and I'm not the final say-so in creative. I liken this to any other television show. You know, The West Wing had a rabid fan base when Aaron Sorkin, who, by the way, is also from Scarsdale, New York, must be in the water. When Aaron Sorkin was the showrunner and the creator and the lead writer and executive producer, when he took a step back for a year and then other people came in, it was a different show. When he came back, he had to pick up where the new storylines had gone, and it was a different feel to the show, and it appealed to some new people, and it turned off some of the old people. The same thing happened on Dallas back in the 80s when Leonard Katzman left the show for a while. This is not Paul Heyman's vision for ECW. This is Vince McMahon's and WWE's vision for ECW, with Paul Heyman saying, hey, let's take it down this road in your way. Hey, if you want to go in that direction, here's an authentic ECW flavor to that concept. It's not going to be what I had it back in the 90s. It's clear that it's not going to be. But there's no way for me to make it that way. I can sit here and argue my head off. It's not going to be the same as it was. So then the choice becomes, does Paul Heyman pull out and say, screw you, this is not the ECW that I love, that was my religion, that was my life, and I don't want any part of this, and walk away, and it's going to move on without me anyway? Or does Paul Heyman stay involved and say, well, if you're going to do it this way, at least let's try it in this fashion, or let's go down this avenue? You can't have input from the outside. The only input you can have is from the inside. So I would dare suggest that if I wasn't involved, it would be even more dramatically different than the old days or the old concepts, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, they kind of go on to say how at this time, I assume his work was his number one priority, but that's not really the case anymore. It's his kids that are his main priority, and I imagine fatherhood has probably kind of mellowed him out. And I do wonder what this new Paul Heyman would be like in a kind of a creative environment.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Paul Heyman today could do what he did with ECW and dedicate that amount of time and that obsession to one particular thing. I don't know how healthy it would be for a guy in his mid-40s with a family to be undertaking something like that. Like, maybe he could do it. Maybe he would know how to delegate a whole lot better than he did in ECW. But the initial idea of bringing back ECW was this to strictly be a digital project where
basically what NXT is.
Yeah, where it would have lived on WWE.com and essentially the reins would have been off. Like, they would have been able to present the product they want, because there would be less influence from the WWE structure, but once they sent out feelers and Sci-Fi was willing to pay them for another hour of programming,
pay-per-view providers were willing to pay for carry the shows,
this thing became a WWE vehicle.
Well, I thought it was a mistake to resurrect the brand from day one, and I have memo after memo after memo just documenting that. I thought it was just a terrible idea to make it a full-time property. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I was willing to come in and attach my name to it because, number one, that was my assignment, and I was an employee, and I was under contract. That's kind of A. Now, here's B to that. 2B would be, I always felt that, God, imagine how shitty it's going to be without me.
Yep.
Because I heard some of the concepts that were being floated around, and I said, wait a minute, you got to have a finish in every match. At least let's do that. Hey, let's honor every stipulation. You know, let's do some things with this brand that keep it separate and distinct from Raw and SmackDown. If you truly want to offer an alternative, here are the alternatives that have to happen. You know, I was not advocating coming back with flaming tables and barbed wire and unprotected chair shots and blood in the matches. It's not the product that I was looking for. I was actually looking for a more MMA-based, persona-driven product, a kind of pro-wrestling version of what's making UFC so hot, but really character-driven. Which is why one of the first people that we wanted was Kurt Angle. You know, so I came aboard because, one, that was my obligation as an employee, and two, because I felt that without me fighting for it, and to be blunt, I didn't see anybody in WWE with the balls to fight for it, nor the motivation to fight for it. And those who had the motivation didn't have the balls, and those who do have some balls had no motivation about the product. It's not their product. They didn't live through it, and they don't give a damn. So I was the only one really in that position to fight for it. And I did. I mean, I fought for it with everything that I had. And as every week went by, little by little, it kept changing to the detriment of the brand and became just another version of Raw or SmackDown with less star power and less resources attached to it. So I always had reservations about the brand being resurrected. I didn't have reservations about being involved because I was at least going to try to protect at least some of the things that would make it different.
Styles flat out said that the WWE ECW version sucked.
I love that. This, as far as I know, this is the first kind of look back at the ECW from the WWE.
It's interesting because Heyman believes if they had used any other letters than ECW, this thing could have worked.
Like NXT.
I think NXT is essentially what it would have become,
mm-hmm.
where you bring back all these familiar ECW names, but the hope was always to transition it into almost a developmental league and present something different, yep. which is really, you know, it had some success in terms of introducing guys that would eventually go on to the main roster. But I think ECW, it put such an expectation on it that it was just, there was no way it could succeed.
An expectation that was completely different from what the WWE could provide, with the large arenas, with the kind of the flashiness of the production, or even just sort of the hokiness of a lot of the writing and a lot of the characters that were imposed upon him.
Yeah, and this was really where things just came apart between Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman, just going back and forth. It was constant battles where Heyman would be throwing out all these ideas. They'd be shot down. The WWE would want to force upon certain ideas. And it was just such a battle between the two that culminated in December to Dismember.
We're only a few days away from the pay-per-view, and fans are very unsure with what's going to happen. I mean, there's only two matches have been announced publicly. Can you give us any teasers as to what's going on here?
Well, it was a decision that was made from the very top of the company that the main event and the special attraction of the one night only deal between the Hardys and Eminem are both such huge events that anything else waters down the lure of the pay-per-view, and that if there is a selling point to the pay-per-view, you focus on and you put the spotlight on the top match, which is the Extreme Elimination Chamber, and the six participants involved in the ECW World title, and the special attraction of the Hardys versus Eminem One Night Only. That was the decision that was made, and it's a marketing tool that seems to have been successful in the past, and it's not unlike how we used to handle ECW pay-per-views anyway, so I'm not that much against it.
A horrendous pay-per-view, one of the worst the WWE has ever presented, and one of the lowest purchase pay-per-views in wrestling history. Actually, that would be not including any TNA pay-per-views. It was well above even the highest TNA pay-per-view. But in WWE history, terrible, like 90,000 buys worldwide. It was a horrendous bomb, and it led to Heyman being sent home the next day, and that would be the last time you'd see Heyman was at that December show until he would come back with Lesnar in 2012.
Now, the last time we had you on the show, it was the Friday before the December to Dismember show. You were chatting with our co-host, Jason Agnew, and the interview ended with you telling Jason, I've got an interview right now with or a meeting with Vince McMahon. Can you summarize what went on that week leading up to that pay-per-view, as well as the fallout, which ultimately ended with yourself and Vince McMahon realizing the two could not work together?
Yeah, that was a really bad meeting that I walked into, too. Man, that boy. You know, it's funny because I usually remember the interviews that I do because I tend to not do that many. And I don't even remember the interview. I know now that you mentioned it, but I didn't remember it until you did.
Well, it was really good, Paul. It was an excellent interview.
I must have been on autopilot because that week was just hell. You know, here's what happened. You can point fingers all you want, okay? From Vince McMahon's perspective, he bought the rights to ECW. It's his company. He can do anything that he wants with it. That's his judgment, his right, his privilege. End of the day, you can't take that away from him. And if he wants to take it in a certain direction, that's his prerogative. It's his company. He owns it. From my perspective, the manner in which you implement that, you know, can be civil and can be reasonable and can be rational. And I just felt that it wasn't. The basic problem between Paul Heyman and Vince McMahon boiled down to is that Vince McMahon is addicted to competition. And when I sat down with him, this is back in 97, back in 97, and we were talking. This was during when we did some appearances on Monday Night Raw to help promote our own pay-per-views.
Right.
And I remember that Vince was, we were in the Manhattan, this was when we did the Manhattan Center invasion, and Vince was using an electric razor to shave his beard or his stubble, and he was grinding it into his face so brutally. It looked like the guy was trying to hurt himself. And he could tell that I was just laughing about it. He looked at me and he says, my daughter, you know, who's Stephanie? He says, my daughter says I compete with my own beard. And that's Vince. You know, everything with Vince is a competition. He lives for the competition. He thrives on it. He's addicted to it. He needs it in his life. So there was no competition for Vince. The only competition really was from UFC for the domestic pay-per-view buy, and if you really come down to it, there's nothing he can do to fight that fight. That's a fight that it's either the product's working and it moves forward and sells more pay-per-view, or the product's not working and it sells fewer pay-per-views. There's nothing Vince can do really to try to outposition UFC, at least not at this moment. So the nearest thing Vince had to competition was he had the ECW brand under his umbrella. He had the guy that is credited, rightly or wrongly, with the notoriety of the creative product called ECW under his employ. That's me, and he wanted to compete for it. Well, this is a predetermined finish here. This is like walking into the main event of WrestleMania and saying, you wonder who's going to win. No, you don't wonder who's going to win. You know who's going to win because it's a predetermined finish. So when he owns the company and the person in charge of creative is under his employ, the predetermined finish is Vince's way is going to happen. So I would write out a show, and Vince would gleefully want to change it.
just so that in his heart he can say, I made a decision about ECW and overruled Paul Heyman. I competed with him and I won. Well, no shit, you won. It's your company, and I'm your employee. And it became a competitive environment for Vince, at least, over the product. And I was sitting there tapping from day one, saying, hey, let's just make this the best product we can make it. And he just wanted to prove points that he could make the changes. So it became an unbearable personal situation. I had tried to resign. I mean, when I did that interview with Jason, I mean, if that was the Friday before the show, I had been trying to resign for the three weeks prior. And I'd, you know, given my resignation to Stephanie several times, and even once in front of the entire writing staff, just in the name of the product. I said, you know, this product is suffering because all we're doing is fighting over it. Let me go. You know, I'll get out of the way of the product. Maybe if someone else is sitting here, Vince will at least listen to them, because it's apparent to me that this has gotten real personal. He's competing with me over a product that he owns. So let me get out of the way. And then at least we all have happier lives. And Stephanie kept trying to mediate between me and Vince and try to make the peace. And that's to her credit. And that was funny because, you know, we had butted heads for so long, and here she was stepping in and trying to make the peace. So at the end of the day, it just became a matter of a personal clash between me and Vince that Vince couldn't get by, and I just didn't want to subject myself to it anymore, or subject the brand to it anymore, subject the legacy of the brand to it anymore. And it was obvious to me that it was just time to go. You know, it was just, why work in that environment? Why subject yourself to it? And why even just make more of an enemy out of Vince when, you know, I always liked Vince, and obviously, you know, we had come to an impasse, and it was just time to get the F out of there.
I just love hearing, you know, guys like Tommy Dreamer, guys like Paul Heyman, and even Stephanie talk about the failed experiment that was their version of ECW. And Tommy Dreamer, with a beautiful analogy, tying back to our discussion earlier, about how ECW, towards the end, was basically, it was being treated like the child in a battle between the child's father and its new stepfather in Vince McMahon. So there's some more step-sibling drama for you.
Look at that. What a theme we've stumbled upon in this particular show. And then the final part. Usually these are my least favorite parts of a WWE DVD. It's the feel-good.
What's he up to now?
He's so great.
It was more than that. He kind of talks about his life after WWE. Briefly mentions
the Strikeforce deal.
Wanting to buy Strikeforce at the time. How he mentions that would have involved Brock Lesnar somehow. How would it have involved Lesnar?
Well, at the time when they were talking, it was Heyman had gotten a group of investors who were looking to purchase Strikeforce, and then parts of the deal changed. I don't know what the specifics were that changed, but Heyman didn't want to be a part of the deal any longer and backed out, so it never happened. But if you remember, Brock Lesnar, he had his first MMA fight, which was outside of the UFC, against the infamous Minsoo Kim
K-1.
At the K-1 Dynamite show, which was what a show that was, called by our good pal Mauro Ranallo. And the most noteworthy part of that fight, and it wasn't like it was a... I mean, there was interest in it.
It was supposed to be Hongman Choi.
It was to be Hongman Choi, and he got flagged by the California State Athletic Commission at the time because he had giantism. He had a tumor that produced artificial testosterone, or excessive testosterone, nonetheless, and was taken off the card. So it was a late opponent switch. And then it wasn't like it was a huge publicized fight. Like, Lesnar fighting was interesting to people, but it's not like this was a big successful show. It was not at all.
I think they wanted it to be a highly publicized show, but they just didn't have the promotional power.
But what I remember so much about that was Bill Goldberg's call of Lesnar's stoppage, where maybe this is where Lesnar actually got the hyena yell from, because let's hear Bill Goldberg calling the finish as Brock Lesnar gets his first professional mixed martial arts win.
Minsoo Kim trying to keep him in stop by eating him. That's it. And excited here at ringside.
That was a call away.
It was. What stood out to me about that was just how, I don't know, how blatantly unbiased Bill Goldberg was in his celebration.
Well, he had his pick.
Yeah.
That's
way
his
to,
guy.
Way to go, buddy.
Nobody. So, but presumably, you know, as Lesnar, he signed with the UFC a number of months later and then would come in for the Frank Mir fight in February of 2008. But Heyman explains in the documentary that he had not signed Lesnar, but the business plan included Lesnar having his mixed martial arts debut with Strikeforce. And that's a really interesting what-if scenario of how things would have gone differently. Had the UFC not gotten Brock Lesnar, had he signed a long-term deal with Strikeforce and he did all of his fights over there with Strikeforce, would Fedor have still gone over to Strikeforce? Would that fight have happened? Maybe. There's a lot of what-ifs with that scenario. Mm-hmm. Strikeforce having Lesnar and Gina Carano potentially.
And Kimbo Slice.
And
I'm sure we would have seen that fight.
It could have happened. I mean, Elite XC was still around at this point when, you know, these talks with Strikeforce and Heyman were going on where Kimbo Slice and Gina Carano were. But Elite XC was going out of business regardless of where Brock Lesnar ended up, regardless of if Heyman got into the industry. And, yeah, Kimbo Slice and Gina Carano becoming available, Cyborg and Carano, I'm sure that fight would have happened. And you couple that with Lesnar with the right opponent, and I think you would have still brought the wrestling audience over just to a different promotion. Maybe not at the level that UFC was because of their muscle in promoting that fight.
I don't, you know, I still would have felt like he wouldn't have gotten the respect if he didn't win that UFC title, if he wasn't involved in the heavyweight division of what was considered the highest, you know, caliber of talent.
Well, I was hot for the Strikeforce promotion at the time because I'm a real big fan of Scott Coker. And I think he's done something that's really hard to do. He created a brand. He built the brand in his market. It has great name recognition in his market. It has brand loyalty from the audience in his market. And it's a really quality product run by a really quality guy. And you just look at different – and I happen to love the name Strikeforce, too, because it's just different. It's not the three letters that everybody else goes for, you know, UFC or ECW or WWE or TNA or WCW or AWA or whatever. It's different. It's a different name. It's a different brand. It's a different product, and it's run by a very quality guy. And I had enough people that were chasing me since the 90s to get involved in mixed martial arts – that I said, you know what, this is something I may want to try. And it was just with the right people. We had the right people involved, and we had the right network people that were interested in talking about a television product. And at that time, which is almost 2 years ago now, it was just the right move to make at the right time. I certainly would not turn a blind eye to MMA. I'm very interested in mixed martial arts, and I'm a huge fan, and I'm a huge UFC fan, too. I mean, there's no doubt about it. If I thought that I could bring something interesting into the mix, and if I thought that it would be something that I could be proud of, and if I thought it was something that, bluntly, I could make a lot of money on, I would be very interested in it. I wouldn't be interested in just trying out a show or producing a pay-per-view or, hey, let's do this one special on these two personalities and build up this fight. I'd want to do something substantive and memorable and just something that's going to really challenge me and make me a better television producer and things that I can learn about the business myself. And at the end of the day, where everybody makes, you know, some decent coin doing it. So I would not turn a blind eye to MMA. To make a long story longer, or make a long answer longer, it's something I'm very interested in. Doesn't mean I'm ever going to be able to do it, because I would want the circumstances to be really premium for me to jump into that. And again, you know, MMA is a 24/7 deal, because unless you're doing it with UFC, you're Dana White's sworn enemy.
Yep.
And I'm a great admirer of what he's built, and I'm a huge fan of his product, and I understand also that the moment I would jump into that world, this guy's going to be sending torpedoes over to Scarsdale. So, you know, I'd want to be very righteous in my approach, and I'd want to do something that even someone like Dana White, to his credit, would say, hey, you know what? Not bad for the industry. That's a credit to the industry. Our competition or a competitive product or special or whatever, but hey, you know what? that's good for MMA.
They also talk about his Looking for Larry advertising agency.
There's a Nick Diaz cameo in this.
Nick Diaz did have a cameo in this. These were those vignettes that they shot.
For the Heyman Hustle.
Yeah, for the Heyman Hustle. He was working with the video game, the EA Sports game with Nick Diaz. He did one with Gilbert Melendez. Did a number of these spots together. So, yes, Nick Diaz made his way into this. We heard from his partner, Mitchell Stewart. And then it's pretty much discussing just kind of the changes in his life. A lot of focus on his children. Brock Lesnar coming back in 2012 and explaining how he never, ever thought he would come back to the WWE, right up until the point that he was going up in the Stanford elevator to a meeting with the WWE where he was adamant he was not going to return, but did. And you could argue having the best run of his entire career in terms of an on-air personality right now. I would say this run has been at or above anything he's ever done these past 2 years.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. They also kind of go on talking about how he's been helping a lot of the talent of the future. Not necessarily, you know, in a writer's capacity, but just on a sort of an
suggestions.
Advocate, an advocate.
Put
capacity.
The title next to your face.
Yes, exactly.
Including an out-of-character Bray Wyatt.
Briefly. No, I wouldn't even say he was out of character. This is one thing I took away from they did interview Bray Wyatt in a sit-down setting for this documentary, but it was one clip where Bray still talks in his character's voice. It wasn't like he was talking as Husky Harris here. He's still talking in that kind of slow, you know, whispery type of voice. And I thought, I'm sure, you know, that was really considered, especially in his case, because he's certainly a character that you don't want him to break for, you know, something as small as a DVD. He's very much like The Undertaker in that his character should be one that should be very well protected.
Yeah, I agree. And they kind of have gone to those lengths with Bray Wyatt. I was just surprised to see him included in this. It was very brief, but yeah, just a lot of the younger talent is heard from here.
Talked a lot about Renee, and the two really seem to have like a pretty strong bond, at least from the sounds of it in this documentary, how the both of them speak about each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this allowed us to... I guess every interview that they conducted, they ended it by asking the person, "Are you a Paul Heyman guy?" And the only one who said he wasn't was Jerry Lawler, as he laughed at this notion that he's like, fuck no. So that kind of wraps up the documentary. It's about 2 hours in length, and that's only the first disc. Disc 2 and 3 features a lot of stories that didn't make their way into the documentary, and just...
Yeah, what were the other, like, they wouldn't, would they include matches? Like, what were the other...
I think they might have put in the Hell in a Cell involving Punk last year.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much all promos. Okay. Like I don't think anyone was really clamoring for too many of the Paul Heyman classics out there. It was just all promos, which I think is what people wanted. And the best story that they included, in my opinion, was on the DVD where they tell the story about Todd Gordon and when there was the mole situation in ECW where this talent was being sent over to WCW, and Todd Gordon was interviewed for this. So you're cutting back and forth, and I mean, Todd Gordon does not come across too endearing in this. Like, he's just kind of bumbling around trying to explain, they were my friends, I was just trying to help out, you know, I wasn't trying to raid ECW, I was like a guy who was almost like he was caught off guard, it felt like, by this question. And Heyman, who I don't care if he completely made up this story from scratch, is so convincing you can't possibly doubt him, explains, "I called Bubba Ray, I called Tommy Dreamer, I called them to my home, and we called, I hacked into Todd Gordon's voicemail, and I heard one after the other of talent responding to Todd's overtures about going to WCW. And he looks at the camera straight in and says, "And Todd, if you think I'm lying, your voicemail was 8405. And does it in like the Paul Heyman conviction where it's just, goddamn, his delivery is like a 15 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And it's that man's ability. He could tell you any story and you walk away convinced it's the truth, whether there's shades of gray in it or not.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, just... looking at that alone, just thinking about this man, anytime he's in front of a microphone, he's essentially what it feels like he's cutting a promo because he's so well spoken, you know. So I just found the whole interview throughout this entire documentary to be a great performance in itself. You know, you add the benefit of like kind of sappy music underneath him talking throughout this documentary, and it's really hard not to like this guy. So I really liked this documentary. I thought it was sort of really the definitive look at this guy's story, at least for the time being. And he really seemed to convey, they seemed to convey the story as honestly as I think they could have. For a documentary produced about the guy with the guy in it.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty well balanced in terms of just having dissenting views on it, which I think really helps any kind of a documentary to basically here are the positives, here are the negatives, and let the viewer take away what they will and draw their own conclusions. So.
So I'm looking at this 3-disc set, and essentially disc 2 and 3 are. Just they're all promos starting from his AWA career all the way through WCW, ECW, and the WWE, and there are only 3 matches, and those matches are the original Midnight Express versus the new Midnight Express from Crockett? Where was that?
This would have been WCW.
Okay, and then you also had the Hardy Boys versus Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman from Judgment Day in 2002.
Oh, a classic.
And of course a no disqualification handicap elimination match from Night of Champions with CM Punk versus Kurt Axel and Paul Heyman. So those are the matches you get. But, I mean, just look at the list of promos. I think anybody who appreciates the art of the promo should check out these bonus discs. It's just, a lot of promos and stories, too.
Yeah, so I definitely recommend this DVD. There's also the Blu-ray version, which has separate extras on it, including one that Paul Heyman says was a story from Stephanie McMahon that made him cry when he watched it.
Wow.
So, legit cry, which he actually did in that promo, legit cry.
Mm.
All right, so those were our thoughts on Ladies and Gentlemen, My Name is Paul Heyman. And we'll now send it over to the feedback thread as you have posted your thoughts on this documentary, which hasn't been out too long. But those of you that have seen it, let's start off with Gaurav, a message board favorite from India. Really glad that you guys chose to review this DVD. I thoroughly enjoyed Heyman's narration of his life. The documentary blew my mind. Heyman grabs your attention just by the way he talks. That's genius right there. I wish they had also interviewed Austin and Undertaker, as Heyman played a significant part in their careers as well. The best story was told by Joey Styles on the Blu-ray extras about Heyman no-showing Joey's wedding. You're right, Joey. Nobody can follow that story. This DVD is apparently doing very well, and it's nice to see that there's a market for documentaries of non-wrestling personalities. I hear there is one for Lawler in the works. I wish they did one on Jim Ross too. Can you imagine the stories he would tell? Do you guys think that ship has sailed? I wouldn't expect a Jim Ross DVD project anytime soon. Not to say it won't happen, but probably Lawler before Jim Ross happens.
They brought him on board for this.
Yeah, I just don't see them doing an actual whole DVD on Jim Ross right now.
But I do think I think with the CM Punk documentary and with this, they realize that there's – I mean, it's almost like they're – you know what? Even starting from that ECW documentary, I feel like their documentary division is very much catered towards sort of the internet smart mark, quote-unquote, audience. And I mean –
And it's not a small subset either. I mean, the reason that ECW show happened in 2005 was the success of that DVD, which mm-hmm. blew away expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, you couple the DVD with the 2 one-night stand pay-per-views, that made ECW as a whole profitable.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a promotion that technically it was profitable in the black by the end of the day after they were resurrected. And, you know, it was – they were kind of like a – the biggie of pro wrestling, more successful after death.
Life after death, yes. But I'd be very much very curious to know what other projects they have on the go for documentaries that cater towards that specific audience. You know, because I think you bring up a Paul Heyman documentary to a casual fan. I don't know how much interest that would create, but
I don't know how many casual fans you're going to attract with these kind of projects anyway. But
yeah, exactly.
I mean, the Heyman one's doing very well. I think. You have the Daniel Bryan one, I'm sure, at some point, especially with a Ring of Honor infusion to it as well. There's a handful of them you could do.
We go to Tyrone from Fredericton, New Brunswick, who says, this certainly gives Rise and Fall of ECW a run for its money. I find that with a lot of DVDs, they start out hot and rush to the finish, but they took their time with this one. Even Paul going on about how he wasn't on WWF's payroll was lengthy. I wish they'd spent a little more time on the Dangerous Alliance, perhaps with Stone Cold as a talking head. Just seems like an extraordinary stable with Ravishing Rick Rude, Double A, Stunning Steve, Larry Zbyszko, Medusa, that's who I was missing, Medusa, Beautiful Bobby. Excellent. Random notes. Woman was gorgeous, my God. Nothing was held back. Stephanie put down Heyman. Shane got some pretty cool spotlight for being in touch with what WWE fans wanted. Shane, the SmackDown 6, couldn't actually be mentioned, but it's understandable due to Benoit.
We go next to Christian. I feel that WWE have nailed documentaries ever since the Punk one, and this one was the same. I really liked this and felt that nothing was held back with everyone being honest. The range of people interviewed was great, and they were only used in the right spot of Paul's career. There was no Brooklyn Brawler types adding into everything. I was amazed by how much backstage footage of ECW there was. It seemed they always had a camera running for some reason. The only thing I found odd was Stephanie calling Vince so often. Can't she call him Dad? But speaking of dads, I'm glad that the final part of this was Paul Heyman showing how much he loves his kids and how they've changed everything for him.
Dwayne from Ireland. Naturally, the documentary was tremendous. The WWE never fails in this department. And I'm glad it wasn't just filled with talking heads falling over themselves to praise the man like Thy Kingdom Come. I could have easily have sat through another hour and listened to Paul Heyman go into more detail on many of the subjects that were covered. It just felt that some portions of his career were somewhat glossed over a little too quickly, but I guess anything longer than 2 hours would probably start to wear out its welcome. Hint, Raw, 3 hours. The Blu-ray extras, though, were the highlight of the entire set. I would encourage anyone to seek them out, especially the Joey Styles wedding story, as they show so many sides of Paul Heyman's fascinating character. 9.99 out of 10.
Okay, Cole from Philadelphia. Great documentary on Paul Heyman. I felt that WWE showcased Heyman's knack for being able to find new stars to help further the business in an efficient manner. Also, kudos to Paul Heyman for being honest about his successes and failures. I found myself laughing when several wrestlers chose to work that hardcore style during the dying days of ECW for free. Someone needs to tell these wrestlers that there is such a thing as good loyalty and stupid loyalty.
Okay, we go to Martin from London, who says, for me, the Heyman documentary was the best the WWE have released since CM Punk's a couple of years ago. It's just incredible how many talents Heyman has worked with over 30 years and just how young he started. One of the more interesting stories was his short time in Memphis, which is covered in more detail in the extras with comments from Jerry Lawler. The few flaws in the film were the short amount of time spent on his WCW run, in particular the Dangerous Alliance and legal issues preventing him from discussing his problems with Bill Watts. Also, a fair amount of the ECW story is already well known, but Heyman's take on things, including his denial of ever being put on the WWF payroll, was interesting to hear. Overall, it's a great insight into the career of one of wrestling's most influential personalities.
James from Edmonton, this was a very solid documentary. I still enjoy the Punk one more, but this one was good in a different way. I really enjoyed Paul just telling stories and narrating his own life. It's neat to see how much he's seen and how he is connected throughout wrestling history. I was a little confused by the story about Vince helping out ECW when they acquired Flash Funk and Scorpio. The WWF paid ECW $1,000 a week. That's it? They had to have helped them out more than that, didn't they? Maybe I missed something, but the story didn't make sense to me. I enjoyed how they had Stephanie play the villain, even though in the extras she tells a story about a message she got from Paul when Mae Young passed away and how she considers him a friend. Paul is a very fascinating person and comes off very humble for someone who is polarizing to so many inside the wrestling world. And nice to see Renee Paquette get some love as well. That surprised me. The X's are great. I understand why they didn't belong in the main documentary, but I'm glad they were included. It makes a good argument to pick up the Blu-ray. The extra stories I would recommend to see if you haven't are the Todd Gordon mole story, Joey Styles' wedding, and Paul's voicemail message with his kids. Great work.
A lot of praise for these Blu-ray extras.
Yeah, look at that. It's like a commercial here.
All right, we go to Jason, who says, hi, guys. First off, thanks for the hard work that you both do. As for the DVD, I have to say this is the first thing I've ever been able to get my wife to watch that is wrestling-related, and she loved it. Another great documentary release from the WWE. If not the best they have done, then top three.
From G. Hall, this was an excellent package of content. The main documentary itself was fantastic. The extras were second best. I can't complain about the rest either, but that would be how I rank it. Every once in a while, the WWE does amazing work with these projects. In this case, they nailed it. Was it the best or not? I suppose that's subjective, but to criticize this would be rather short-sighted. I can't think of a reason any fan of anything of Paul Heyman's work would be disappointed. With that being said, I will await the review away to hear if you guys nitpick anything I missed.
Okay.
That's what we'd do.
Rinaldo, finally, from Milan, Italy. Great documentary, which is quite the norm for WWE these days. Paul Heyman is a great booker, and after watching this, you get a taste of what a great salesman he can be. After finishing this, you're almost ready to proclaim Paul as the greatest, least understood soul to ever play a role in the wrestling business. Reality is, for any grand tale he can bestow upon the viewers about how he really was not such a jackass as a promoter, there are at least 20 or so guys who can cite the money he still owes them and all the ridiculous promises he made to young talents and how he almost ruined their chance at the big time. I get Paul has the New York mindset of going, I'll tell everyone I'm an asshole before they do, and that will shut them up. But the truth is, this documentary, a 5-star one at that, is so captivating simply because you're telling the story of a con man who has conned his way to the top, up top to success, like in the Ocean's 11 movie. Otherwise, it'd be boring. Top-notch documentary.
All right. Well, thanks, folks, for the feedback. That brings this edition of Review Away to an end. We hope you have enjoyed it. Our thoughts on the Paul Heyman DVD and some clips from the past, I guess, going back to 2006.
Great job digging those up, John. Yep. DJ Jopo.
That's what I do. Yeah. I could have a burgeoning rap career one day, maybe. Yeah. Probably not. All right. We are going to come to a close. But next week on the show, Way, we are going to keep with the Paul Heyman theme. And we're going to go back. It's going to be a wrestling review as we are going to chat about an infamous War Games match from Wrestle War in May of 1992, pitting the Dangerous Alliance against Sting's Squadron.
Sting's Squadron.
Boy, I love alliteration.
Well, who's in the Sting Squadron?
We've got Sting, Nikita Koloff, Dustin Rhodes, Barry Windham, and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, taking on Rick Rude, Larry Zbysko, Bobby Eaton, Arn Anderson, and Steve Austin.
Excellent.
Is that a lineup?
Yes, it is.
Yes, this is a very highly regarded War Games match. So we will turn the clock back 22 years to May the 17th of 1992. This pay-per-view is up on the WWE Network. Unless you live in Canada, you will not find this anywhere amongst their fucking 13 shows of on-demand content. But that will be the review for next week. We will place a feedback thread up so you can catch that. And of course, this week, a bit of a programming change. It's last-minute notice for TNA. Review and Impact will be coming at you Thursday afternoon. We should have the show up by about 2 Eastern. Other shows this week, of course, all our regulars. Alex Greenfield filling in again this week for Court Bauer. He will be joining me.
Why? Where's Court? What's
Court's on vacation. He's probably sick. Who knows? So we'll be chatting with Alex this week. The MMA Report featuring a great chat with the now retired Mark Bocek, a man that Way once got to recite Eazy-E lyrics on camera.
He's a big NWA fan.
Is that interviews? Can we find those lyrics? Because I searched for them on the weekend and I couldn't find them.
Yeah, they're at the end of it. I ended up not.
Oh,
really
they were
it.
They weren't like.
They weren't in a proper piece. They were just sort of in the credit roll of one of our shows.
Oh, okay. Well, those things have like people are still watching those. Ariel Helwani really wants them to come back. Well, but they're retired, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't feel that funny anymore.
Wow.
I've developed a conscience.
Maybe you're where Paul Heyman was in 2009 in regards to ever going back to the WWE. Will you never, ever go back to the weigh-in? Say never.
Yeah, never say never, but maybe not.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up. Of course, the place to go is liveaudiowrestling.com. You can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at Law Radio. Subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes. That's always nice if you can do that. And just follow Way. Just find out what he's doing, what hats he's wearing.
Follow me in person. Just track me.
That's the next evolution of Twitter. Physical Twitter.
Yeah.
So come where people just follow you around everywhere.
Track my list.
Open up your door to go outside of your house and there's a lineup.
That's following.
Like a real shadow.
I have such and such many followers.
Well, Way, I think to go out, instead of music, let's go out with a Paul Heyman promo.
That's a great idea.
And I'm going to have you select the promo.
Oh, okay.
All right?
From this DVD?
Yeah, let's make it easy and make it from the DVD and tie it all in together.
Well, will you at least choose the era, choose the promotion?
You know what? There's a promo from ECW where he talks about TNN kicking them off. Is that not on there?
I don't know. You tell me.
Let me see. Great help, Way.
Anytime.
Oh, there's not. So,
okay. So then, do you think you could find it?
No. Let's. I'll edit this, or I won't. Okay. Here is a promo from ECW in June of 2000. The war has just begun.
Okay. Why? Why?
I don't know. It's just a random one. You pick one.
No.
I want you to pick one.
I like that one.
No, you don't. Look, you should have seen the cut-eye he gave me when I said that.
I actually don't remember most of these promos. So I can't.
Well, which one do you want to hear? If you had this disc and you could watch one of these, what would it be?
I want to hear that one that you just mentioned.
What's it called? The one that you so desired.
The war has just begun.
All right.
The last one. One of the final ones of his ECW career.
Okay. Here it is. The war has just begun, and it would be over, actually, very quickly, when TNN would sign the World Wrestling Federation to a 5-year deal.
My name is Paul Heyman, and I'm the executive producer and the owner of Extreme Championship Wrestling. And since this show apparently is going to make air this week, I'd like to take this moment to thank you for watching ECW. You have to be an ECW fan to watch this show because God knows the network has never put out one freaking commercial or one press release to let you know that we're here. But that's their scheme of things. You see, in just a few weeks, the network is going to give $100 million to Vince McMahon like he needs it to replace us. In case they haven't thrown us off before then. And the fact of the matter is, we're not a publicly funded company like Vince McMahon or WCW. We survive or even thrive on your support. And for that, we thank you. Now, in an industry where everybody wants to be real and everybody wants to do a shoot, this, my friends, is a shoot. We hate this stinking network. We hate their guts for abandoning us. We hate their guts for not supporting us. We hate their guts for not advertising us. And we hate their guts for not having the balls to throw us off the air. And just in case you're watching this, hey, network, I dare you to throw me off the air. Because I'm going to break every rule that you put in front of me until you throw me the hell off the air. Now this, my friends, is a shoot. You better take that $100 million that you're going to give Vince McMahon, and you better spend it on attorneys, because I promise you, network, the war has just begun.